In Genesis 1, at the very beginning of the Bible, we read these words. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. The deep in Genesis 1 is the sea, but not the sea like we would think of it, like when you go to the Atlantic or the Pacific or the Mediterranean, whatever sea that is. The sea that's referred to in Genesis 1 is like the sea that's mentioned in other ancient Mesopotamian creation myths. Mesopotamia being that whole area around the Persian Gulf and Middle East where the Bible kind of was birthed and the people of Israel lived. There was a Mesopotamian people called the Sumerians. They lived there around, say, 3,500 years before Christ. And they also, in their creation myths, made reference to the sea, this same kind of a sea as we mentioned in Genesis 1. It was what gave rise to their goddess Nammu, who was the creation goddess. Amongst the Babylonians sometime later, they had a goddess named Tiamat, who is the personification of this same deep or this sea. And it's out of that sea that the gods, the Babylonian gods, were first created. And also, out of which that sea, out of which came an army of monsters in the Babylonian War of the Gods from before human beings were even created. And so you can see that in ancient stories of creation from lots of different cultures, this idea of the sea, this body of water that is under and around and over the earth. So it's not really just like an ocean we think of it. The Babylonians saw in the sea that it gave rise to monsters, but they weren't the only ones that thought of the sea as being the home and the place of monsters. In our own Bible, in Psalm 74, as just one example of many, in Psalm 74, the psalmist declares to God these words: "You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the dragons in the waters." And so again, the sea is symbolizing chaos and danger and evil things that would rise up. Over time, the sea, and within the Jewish tradition, the sea came to symbolize the nations of the earth or the empires of the earth. When we get to Revelation at the very end of our New Testament, the so-called Whore of Babylon, who symbolized every empire that had ever stood against God, she is seated on the sea. The sea itself in Revelation 17 symbolizes the multitudes and nations and languages. And so I bring all of this up because in Daniel 7, a portion of which Melody just read for us a few minutes ago, in Daniel 7 at the beginning, we find that this is a vision that is filled with symbols that would have been familiar to the early readers of this strange and wonderful book in our Old Testament. And I bring up this whole idea of the sea because that is one of the symbols that would have been very familiar to Daniel's readers. This is what we read in verse 2 and 3 of Daniel 7. "I, Daniel, saw in my vision by night the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea." Daniel is a genre of literature called apocalyptic. It's a challenging genre of literature for us today because we don't really have contemporary parallels to what it was in ancient Judaism and even in early Christianity. Now, in today's day and age, when we think of the word apocalyptic, I think that we tend to think about anything that has to do with the end of the world. We think of movies like Bruce Willis's Armageddon or Will Smith's Independence Day, or you can probably name any number of other movies or books that all have to do with the end of the world. There's stories in which the world as we know it is threatened and is in need of some kind of a savior or somebody to solve things. Maybe there's stories about the world after it's ended as a remnant attempts to survive a harsh new reality. This is what we tend to think of when we hear the word apocalyptic. It's about the end of the world. There's been some catastrophe. It's epic, usually, in the telling of the story. But that's not what was meant when the word is used as a genre of literature that comes out of ancient Judaism and early Christianity. There, the word apocalyptic actually means revelation, which means an unveiling or an unfolding of things that weren't previously known. It has to do with things that were hidden and that are then revealed. And so our last book in our Bible is called Revelation, or in some versions you might have it called the Apocalypse of John. And that's because it's a book that is sharing the mysteries of things that were previously hidden and that are now known through John. But the thing is, the way that they're revealed, they're not revealed in obvious ways in apocalyptic literature. And that's really important to grab onto. It's not like somebody just went, okay, here's the way things have been. Let me just tell you outrun literally exactly what everything is. Because the language of apocalyptic literature is the language of symbol and of metaphor. And rather than being limited to future end of the world events, apocalyptic literature is intended for the here and now, whenever that here and now might be. And so apocalyptic stories and visions, they're told by and in such a way that to an outsider, they're just stories. But to the author's intended audience, the meaning of the symbols and the signs are easily recognizable. And even though those symbols and signs might seem terrifying to those who don't understand them, the stories themselves are always intended to offer encouragement and hope to those who are oppressed. And that's the thing. The apocalyptic literature, as a genre of literature, is the literature of the oppressed masses. It is people who have to work under the radar, who have to get their message out in ways that won't be noticed by the powers that be. And so when I was thinking about that, I was thinking about the similarities that this apocalyptic genre of literature has to modern day African American spirituals. Now you might think, what's that about? I'm going to tell you. Those spirituals acted in the same way among the slaves of the Americas. To the slave masters, the songs that they were singing sounded harmless. But the words carried deeper hidden meaning than their intended audiences, the slaves, knew what it was. The slaves knew that this was about longing to be free. They would have understood. And to explain this better than I can explain it, I have a video. It's just a short video that I want to play for you. This is a video. The person speaking is a woman named Reverend Velma Maya Thomas, and she's talking about these African American spirituals.
The words we're saying have a double meaning. So anytime you hear anything about traveling shoes or chariots or wheels, somebody's getting ready to run. And so you take a Negro spiritual, swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. That chariot is movement. That chariot is swinging low, picking you up, putting you on that Underground Railroad, taking you somewhere to freedom. So when we sing those songs, it's like, something's getting ready to happen. Say, so I looked over Jordan and what did I see? Jordan, that was metaphoric for the Ohio River. A band of angels coming after me. Those conductors coming to help you, coming forth to carry me home. So they had all kind of little messages. And the slave master would hear us singing and say, oh, don't they sound pretty happy tonight? Next day, two or three people gone because we put that message out. We talked about wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade. Wade, wade, wade in the water, 'cause God's gonna trouble the water. So we stepped in that water 'cause the dogs can't pick up your scent. We had all these songs that said, it's time to move. It's time to go by the waterway. It's time to follow the North Star. It's time to start looking. It's time to start traveling. It's time to start getting ready to cross over that Jordan into freedom. Steal away to Jesus. Oh, Lord, they're going on to heaven. No. Steal away home. I ain't got long to stay here. So we steal away to Jesus. We steal away to freedom. But it sounds like we're just talking about a life in the hereafter, but we're talking about a life in the here and now.
Daniel is a book in our Old Testament that is apocalyptic. It's a book that has hidden meaning or double meaning in it. The first six chapters of that book are stories from a time long ago when Israel's people were forced to live under the thumb of the Babylonian Empire. They're stories of resistance. They're stories that tell the importance of righteousness in the face of evil. They're stories of hope, because Israel's God always comes through in every one of those stories. And then the last six chapters of the book are Daniel's visions and dreams. They are filled with wild and wonderful and terrifying symbols, but they have the same purpose as the stories. God is on the side of the oppressed, and so you can hope. In Daniel 7, the chapter that we're honing in on this morning, we read of monsters rising up out of the sea. Now, those who understood the author's hidden meaning back when the book was written, which was likely written in the early second century before Christ, they would have understood that those monsters represented four different empires that had one after the other ruled Israel's known world. The fourth monster, the worst of the bunch, was a man named Antiochus the Great, and he represented the ruthless Greek Empire who had destroyed Israel's temple. It was the worst of the four that had come before. Life under Antiochus the Great was hard, especially for those who wanted to remain true to Israel's roots and religion. And even though there was a brief glimpse of hope when the Maccabeans, a family within Israel's history, they successfully led a revolt and took back Jerusalem from the Greeks, everyone knew that their little rebellion didn't stand a chance against the mighty army that Antiochus wielded. And they knew that he was going to come back in, and he was going to be ruthless, relentless in taking back his place. This whole idea of apocalyptic literature being written in this time, but telling the stories and being placed in a time in the far back, that's a way to make it safe, to make it pleasant for those who might not understand the hidden meanings, because they're, oh, these are just stories out of history. What harm is there in that? And the people who understood the hidden meaning, the people for whom those stories and those visions were written down and distributed, they understood that in those stories, in those visions set in some time in the history, they see also their own time and their own context and their own history, and they take the same hope there. The image of the beast coming up out of the sea to destroy, I think, is just as meaningful for us today as it would have been for Daniel's readers back then. We may not think in terms of nations or empires rising up to oppress us. We don't live in the same kind of a world that they lived in when this book was first written. But aren't there beasts that threaten us nonetheless? I think about beasts like racism and hate. I think about beasts like national pride that gets coupled with violence, about rampant consumerism and addiction. Think about this global pandemic. One of the commentators on Daniel, a man named Gerald Kennedy, he wrote this: "The picture of the beast coming up out of the sea to destroy is one which we can appreciate. There seem to be times like that in human experience. Something stirs the sea, and evils too horrible to contemplate come out and stalk the earth. There is no human defense against them." This is where I want us to pause for a moment, because it's all well and good to talk about the book of Daniel and to talk about the people of Israel and to look back and go, oh, isn't that interesting? Maybe a history lesson, maybe a literature lesson, whatever it is. But the Bible is always intended to speak to us in the here and now. That's kind of the beauty of the apocalyptic literature, is it was written here and it tells the stories from way back here, but it is just applicable to us way over here, because that's what apocalyptic literature does. The hidden meaning, the deeper meaning is the same, whatever your context is. And so I think it's really important for us to stop for a moment and contemplate what the beasts are that plague us. What are the monsters we face? Those things which we seem to have no lasting defense of. I think about somebody who is an addict, and that addiction has control and power over them. And they may at some points for stretches of time feel like they have control back and they have power over it again. And then the addiction weaves its way back in and it wins again, because there is no lasting defense. Human willpower is not enough. That's why if you attend any AA meeting or NA meeting or any kind of Alcoholics type anonymous meeting, the first step in recovery is always admitting that you're powerless. And so these monsters, these beasts, they represent those things that we face that we have no lasting defense over, the things against which we are helpless. And so what I'd like us to do is we haven't done this for a while, but I'm gonna separate you into some breakout groups. Please feel free, if you're not comfortable in your breakout group sharing, please don't feel like you have to speak or you have to share. Just it'd be helpful if you go in anyway so that you can listen to what other people are saying in the group. What are the monsters we face against which we seem to have no lasting defense, against which we are helpless? From where Daniel talks about these monsters that have risen up out of the sea, it's so great because he doesn't leave it there. And this is the thing, apocalyptic literature never, ever, ever leaves it there. It never leaves it at the monsters or the dragons or all the things that are wrong and evil and oppressive and terrifying in the world. And so that's where we get into the verses that Melody read for us earlier. When we move into verse 9, what happens is, so Daniel has written about these monsters that he sees in his vision, and then his gaze, it shifts from the sea and the chaos of the sea up to the heavens. And this is what's happening there. In verses 9 and 10, we see that the Ancient One, sometimes in some translations called the Ancient of Days, who we understand to be referencing God, he's taking his throne, surrounded by his people, prepared to mete out judgment against the monsters, against the oppressors, against all of those evils that we are helpless against. And then you skip ahead to verses 13 and 14, and it continues this vision, this celestial vision where we read of one like a human being. You may have heard this one called the Son of Man, one like a Son of Man. When we get to our Christmas stories, Jesus is sometimes referred to as the Son of Man, and that's who Daniel is referring to. This is Jesus, to whom is given dominion and glory and kingship, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, unlike that of the monsters who came before, who have power, who wield great power for a time, but it always passes away. And his Jesus kingship is one that shall never be destroyed. This is our hope in the midst of a world that perhaps seems to be careening more and more out of control. And you came up with all sorts of things that feel like they are out of control, that we are defenseless against. In the midst of a world full of monsters, our God, who is the Ancient of Days, who we know through his Son, Jesus Christ, is on our side. Nothing that stands against us will be forever. The only thing that is forever is our God's kingdom, which is from everlasting to everlasting. Whatever is plaguing you, whatever monsters you're fighting these days, or running and hiding from these days, nothing but God is forever, and God never leaves us alone in it. I chose to include communion in this morning's service because the image of Jesus' broken and bleeding body, and then that of one like a human being standing before the throne and being granted an everlasting dominion. They are two images that seem so opposite. But that's the way of God's kingdom. On the one hand, we have this executed teacher. And on the other hand, we have the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and they are the same person. That's the way of Jesus' kingship. That's the hope that Daniel offered his people. Those who seem the least likely, the smallest and the weakest, are those to whom God's kingdom belongs. Those who were understanding the hidden meaning in the apocalyptic literature, they are the ones to whom God's kingdom belongs. When we come to the communion table, whether it's a physical table around which we gather or a table we imagine because we're here on Zoom, we come not just as an act of remembrance, which is often how we think of communion, an act of remembering Jesus who died for us. But we also come because, in the Apostle Paul's words, as often as we eat this bread, as often as we drink the cup, we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. In other words, as we participate in communion, we declare that through Jesus' death, Jesus became the Christ, who is the one like a human being or the Son of Man, to whom God has given everlasting dominion over his everlasting kingdom. That's what we are declaring. It's not just an act of remembrance, but it's saying this crucified Lord, he has been given everlasting dominion over his everlasting kingdom. That is the truth. That is the hope that we cling to, the hope that we declare.